Hey guys, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
And we try not to throw around a bunch of assumptions on this show, but we're about to make an assumption. And this assumption is about you guys, the listeners.
Yeah. We're guessing that at one time or another in your lives, you've been in some sort of workplace training, professional development, that type of thing.
Yes, the team building exercise.
Exactly. Well, if you've done any of that, then this should sound familiar.
I want to get you guys involved in an activity really quickly. I need about 10 to 12 volunteers. If we could go back over here, and everybody else can kind of follow around, you know, so I need 10 to 12 volunteers.
Ugh, the dreaded pitch for volunteers.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I can imagine some of you guys groaning right now. Group activities, I'm just going to be honest right now, group activities in the workplace kind of make me squirm.
Totally. But we want you to suspend those feelings for a second. In fact, let them go entirely.
Because this training we're hearing right now is not your average rah-rah team exercise.
For starters, it's about as far away from the woods and obstacle courses as you can get. There are no trust falls. Instead, trainer Moyinda Enwiche, the guy you heard asking for volunteers, is corralling dozens of educators into the small library at Adams Elementary School in South St. Louis. The group has just finished listening to a presentation by Moyinda and his partner Jean-Pierre Mitchum about restorative justice.
So restorative justice is a philosophy that encourages collaboration from the violator, victim, and community.
Now that the lecture is over, it's time to get everyone up and moving. Moyinda strolls to the back corner of the library where he picks up a roll of string and sets the objective.
We're going to create a visual of this community.
As teachers and administrators get up from chairs built for much smaller people, there's really no grumbling.
Yeah, everybody seems into it.
Yeah, kind of like they're eager to get in on this group activity. Anyways, a circle forms and everyone else gathers around and waits. Moyinda unwinds some of the string and tosses it to one of the teachers.
Okay, now wrap that one around your finger and then you toss it to somebody else in the circle. Try to get it so it's off the ground.
The teachers throw the bundle of string around until there's a web of rope connecting everyone in the circle.
So let's, we could go and wrap some more, but I want to just think about what we have right here, right? So this is the web. These are people on the outside and those surrounding are part of this community, right? All right. So is our culture strong or is it weak? Well, we don't know because we haven't tested it yet, right?
And this is where it gets interesting. Moyinda reaches down and grabs a giant stuffed animal that's the shape of an alligator, which happens to be the mascot at Adams.
All right, I'm going to throw it out. Three, two.
All this commotion you hear, it's because the alligator actually falls through the gaps in this stringy net.
The teachers firm up their grip on the string and give it one more try. The alligator goes up in the air, and this time, the stuffed animal floats on the top of the web. Moyinda has made his point.
Look at an alligator.
So, what makes it strong? How are we able to support the alligator? What is the nature of everybody's tension on the string?
The string.
I'll pull just a little tight. If everybody pulls just a little bit, we can fix the situation.
So what if this gentleman here, this young lady here, this young lady here decide, you know what, I'm done. This is too hard work. I'm out. What happens?
Okay.
It weakens. Right. And everybody else then has to work harder.
Right.
Okay. And so then what does that do to the culture of the community? And then how does that then impact the kids that we are sent here to
educate? Some people are important and some are not.
Did you catch all that? It may have been a little hard to hear. When Moyinda asks how gaps in a school's culture impacts kids, a teacher responds that it causes a breakdown. And the students, she says, sense this.
From the restorative process, we understand that there are going to be things that occur. Restorative process helps us to be able to go through those kinds of tough times and then be able to solve those problems without harming the community. The community should be able to absorb. If the community is strong, it should be able to absorb threats to it that come from conflict, such as they don't get out of hand, they don't... become killers to what it is that we're trying to create.
It's that the teachers and administrators at this tiny neighborhood school are trying to create will probably sound familiar to most educators. Adams Elementary is on a mission. equitable education and opportunities for all of its 300 students.
We know it sounds simple enough and lofty to boot, but as educators all around the country will acknowledge, that goal is far easier said than done. So what does it really take to do this in a place like St. Louis?
In a moment when there's a national conversation about racial disparities.
When angst about suspensions and school-to-prison pipelines are high.
And when many in the education system, teachers, principals, and sometimes parents, feel ignored, disrespected, overwhelmed, and under-resourced. How do you really build equity in education?
On today's show, we zoom in on one St. Louis school to see if we can get some answers.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here. Before we get back to school, we should note that you can kind of think of today's episode as a follow-up of sorts to some investigative reporting we did this past spring.
We analyzed suspension data for every school district in Missouri and found huge racial disparities, especially when it comes to discipline in the early grades.
In fact, our analysis showed that though black children make up only 17% of kindergarten through third grade students in the state, they received almost 70% of all out-of-school suspensions in the school year that ended in 2015. And St. Louis Public Schools sat atop that trend.
The mostly black district issued 857 out-of-school suspensions to kindergarten through third grade students in 2015, the most of any district in Missouri. And not one of those out-of-school suspensions went to a white student.
So many of you local listeners probably already know this, but just a short time after our podcast about this issue came out, days actually, St. Louis Public Schools made a big, big announcement. District Superintendent Kelvin Adams, with approval from the school board, said students in pre-K through second grade could no longer be given out-of-school suspensions. The new ban went into place this fall.
Now, obviously, we can't give you guys an update on statewide suspension numbers just yet. We'll do that in season three. But our reporting on this topic never really stopped, which is how we ended up at Adams Elementary.
So here are some quick facts about Adams. All of the students at the school qualify for free or reduced price lunch, a common measure of poverty, and almost all of them are black. And the elementary school has struggled to raise students' level of academic performance in recent years.
As you heard at the top of the show, the educators at this school have been doing a lot of work around the idea of community and the culture of equity.
They've also been actively working, even before the ban was announced, to curb suspensions and rethink discipline methods.
So about a month after that summertime professional development day in the library that we went to.
The one with the alligator.
Yes, we went back to the school.
Good morning, Mr. Coleman.
Good morning,
Mr. Coleman.
Good morning.
It's about 8 in the morning and Principal Cameron Coleman has just walked into the school's cafeteria. Students fidget in their seats as they eat breakfast. It's only a couple of weeks into the school year and Coleman is still trying to memorize all the names of his new students.
Well, at kindergarten, it's my first day capturing his face. Mm-hmm. I think he started yesterday. His first day.
This all seems pretty nice. Pretty routine. But stick with us here because Coleman is about to do something kind of remarkable. He walks out to the playground. Kids are running all over the place, having a great time. Some of them start to look at him as he walks by. Then, without saying a single word, Principal Coleman raises his hands.
Kids immediately stop what they're doing and form perfect lines for each grade.
And we're trying to remove all of the things that we do in schools that they might do in something like a kennel. So we don't whistle or blow or sound alarms or have bells. We're trying to increase the common and intimate social human interaction. And it brings a certain level of care. So I just walked onto the playground and I put my hands up and I bring my arms towards me. Good morning. And all of the students notice that we're walking towards the front and they walk and they get in their lines. It's that simple.
Coleman paces back and forth in front of the kids. Imagine his demeanor as equal parts football coach, military general, and CEO. He then leads them in this daily chant.
Every student at Adams Elementary School, I pledge to be the best that I can be at all times, because I am somebody. I pledge to obey classroom rules.
students then walk to class in silence. Coleman whispers to me that this level of precision is no accident. For example, school staff have mapped out the most efficient routes to classrooms to maximize instruction time. And they even track the average amount of time it takes for each student to use the restroom.
It's about 2 minutes. And every student has to read a book while they wait to use the restroom. As students settle into their classrooms, Coleman takes us to what he calls the war room. It's the nerve center for tracking student data.
Be as meticulous as we can about examining student achievement data in order to provide the most efficient and productive way to educate them.
Posted on every wall are charts and graphs detailing test scores, attendance, and behavior. To make sense of all of this, each student gets a color-coded card. Coleman uses reading outcomes to show us how this works.
Red, orange, blue, and green bands indicate where a student is with reading expectations. So at the end of first grade, all except 4 students were reading at least 1 grade level above, entering second grade reading on at least a 3rd grade level, and these kids reading starting second grade on a 2nd grade level.
So if I'm looking here, you've only got one that would be below where you'd want them to be.
Correct.
Coleman then walks over to a different chart that shows suspensions over the past couple school years.
As you can see here, in about a year ago, between about 9% of our administrative actions constituted in-school and out-of-school suspension, up to 13% in October. 14% in November. So right around then, we started saying, hey, we really have to do something. When we start problem solving for a student, we'll start with discipline, attendance, and work our way back. And we saw a very clear indication that if a student was suspended or not, did not change advancement at this level. Mm-hmm. So it didn't benefit anybody.
Right.
So we started figuring out how to support kids in school.
So what does it take to fully support kids in school? Kids who may face extraordinary challenges because of their skin color.
Or how much their family makes. And how is Coleman figuring all this out?
Well, he's getting a little help from this guy.
Hi, my name is Norman White. I'm a faculty member at St. Louis University in the Criminology and Criminal Justice program.
And Norm was responsible for setting up the restorative justice training that Camille and I went to over the summer at Adams Elementary.
But before we get into all the things he's doing, let's ask an obvious question. What's a criminologist doing mucking around in education policy?
Where initially I had wanted to do work on looking at the system, I began to think about how do I change the system by changing the feeder. So my interest immediately went to schools because I have always thought that school is like a critical place.
Norm says the desire to intervene became urgent after the 2014 killing of Michael Brown, and subsequent headlines singling out Missouri and St. Louis as having some of the nation's highest school suspension rates.
Borrowing a phrase from protesters, Norm formed a program called Shut It Down. It's funded with a 5-year grant from the Missouri Foundation for Health.
It's being piloted in 7 elementary schools in St. Louis, including Adams Elementary.
While the initial goal is to help schools reduce suspensions, Norm says he's ultimately trying to get teachers to better understand the dual pressures of racial inequality and poverty.
W.E.B. Du Bois in 1896 said that it's not enough. If you have a single social problem, that's one thing, right? So if you're in an area and you're studying it as a single social problem, that's a problem. If you're in an area that has lots of those problems, that's a problem. But the problem is that they all exist together, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that the combination in and of itself is something that has to be taken on. If you don't take it on, then you are really not solving anything. You're putting Band-Aids on pieces that just don't change it.
Norm and his partners offer training on trauma, restorative justice, and data analysis. They're also helping the schools build what he calls resource quilts.
Now, he doesn't mean literal quilts. He means making sure people, kids and adults, have what they need inside the school and also creating partnerships with outside organizations.
Norm says the key, though, is customizing a plan to the school. So at Adams, it's meant trainings like the one we saw this summer.
At other schools, Norm has helped facilitate home visits between teachers and families. And he says the pressures facing educators in high poverty schools can be overwhelming.
you know, that they have a hard job. They have kids who are experiencing life in ways that we can't understand. It's just not imaginable. You know what I mean? It's really hard to imagine. I tell the story, and I don't know if I've told you this before, but the going to a school that I have some students working in, and we were talking to the woman in the parent office, and at like 2:45, she looks up at the clock and says it's going to get busy in here, and that the students go, why is it going to get busy? And she responds to the two students that I was with, that it's going to get busy because good students are going to come in and they're going to want to know where they go. And the natural reaction to that was, you mean what program? Like, are they going to go to the gym? Are they going to go to art? Are they going to go to tutoring? And she said no, and she pushed the phone across the desk to where one of them was sitting and said, I'm going to put the phone where you are, and they're going to sit in that seat, and they're going to call mom and ask her, where do I go tonight to sleep? Because a lot of the kids in this school are homeless. And it was just, you know, this was in the middle of the time when students are studying for the MAP test.
Which is the state assessment.
So the stakes are high. Right. Students are in school. You have kids sitting in a classroom trying to study for a test that's going to make the determination of whether their school district or their school gets funding or how they get treated. And they're thinking about life. Where do I sleep tonight? Do I eat tonight? That's a reality we have to know. That's a reality that I think the school district deserves to be public.
St. Louis Public Schools' ban on out-of-school suspensions in the early grades came shortly after Norm started his program, and many observers at the time championed the move.
But Norm says for the people he was working with, even the ones who were already trying to change, it was scary.
I'm not sure that the tools are available, or I don't know that the teachers or the principals feel they have the tools at the moment to respond to having their hands completely tied. Not that they want to suspend kids, don't get me wrong, but they have to have the resources to respond to behavior or challenges that kids face.
Trepidation from educators about the ban isn't just an assumption on Norm's part. We've heard it over and over again from many teachers and administrators over the past few months.
Even Adams Elementary principal Cameron Coleman, who'd already quietly instituted his own building-wide suspension ban ahead of the district's policy, says he's unsure if a top-down solution can work for everyone right now.
Let me ask you just straight up, do you think it's a good decision on the part of St. Louis Public Schools to ban those out-of-school suspensions in the early grades?
I do think that the concept is a healthy one. I think that there are levels of preparation that should happen. It's the same thing that we did here. You have to know how you're going to replace the behavior. I think the exception is this was such a small scale, and we had some training, and we had shut it down as a resource. So when I run my repertoire is empty, I have somebody to go to. The whole district, you know, they don't have that. So if it were me, I might have been sure some different things were in place before. Of course, I don't know everything that went into the decision making, and I'm definitely not smarter than the superintendent.
So coming up, we talk to the man ultimately responsible for making sure this new ban on early grade suspensions actually works. When St. Louis Public Schools announced this past spring that it was banning out-of-school suspensions for students in preschool through second grade, it became one of only a handful of school systems in the entire country to do so.
Even though conversations about suspensions, and especially their impact on Black and brown children, has been part of a national conversation for the past few years, few school systems have completely taken the discipline option off the table.
St. Louis Public Schools Superintendent Kelvin Adams says he came to see his top-down policy decision as one of the only ways to bring systemic change.
We tried to do it informally without coming up with a quote-unquote policy and indicating from the superintendent's perspective and also principal's perspective we're not going to do this. But, I do think this is the best way. After being here 7 years, we looked at data, we tried a number of different things, and I think at the end of the day, a policy that says you cannot do it along with support. So I think we looked at our budget, we made some adjustments, and the policy was reinforced by doing those kinds of things as well.
And Adams has promised more support. Thanks in part to the passage of a tax increase last spring, the district has added 23 new support staff members. A few weeks ago, the federal government announced it was giving St. Louis, Baltimore, and Chicago money to do more mental health work in schools. St. Louis's share is $1.4 million.
And then there's more training like Norm White's Shut It Down program, which is working with a total of 7 elementary schools across the district. But even with all of this, Adams acknowledges they could have done a better job including staff in the decision-making process and lining up extra resources.
What I'm saying ultimately is that we understand that this is larger than a policy. We realize and understand we have to train our staff, and we're seeking additional dollars through grants and other philanthropic efforts to make sure that we are doing that, if you want to call background work or backroom work, to make sure staff is being addressed. Principals are correct. A policy was put in place. They got some support. They need more support, and we are working to make sure that we are doing that.
Adam says making this move, even if it's resulted in some anxiety, has forced the district to acknowledge it has a problem.
Secondly, it forced me as a superintendent to find resources to support schools, and it forced principals to come up with different kinds of strategies to support kids in that building. So I think it really changed everybody's mindset around what needed to be done to support the kid.
Even though it's just a couple weeks into the school year, this shift in mindset is already apparent at Adams Elementary.
Because one might think that without the ability to suspend, you can't control the environment in your school.
Again, this is Principal Cameron Coleman.
But there's in between a perfect school and suspension, there are all these things in between. And you just have to figure out what fits for you. What fits for us may not fit for someone else. You have to examine the threshold of your teachers. I did have a teacher transfer out. I mean, it may not be for you. You have to be committed to this idea for this to work for you. Because we don't suspend here. And I had a kid do something I would have given 10 days a year ago. And he did it this year. And I remember thinking, I want this teacher to feel supported. This student threw something at the teacher. And I want this teacher to feel supported. I don't want her to feel like she's walking into an environment where anything may happen and she has to face the same students again. So we called mom in, and it's a very easy and palatable story. Mom and dad both work. Mom's a very hard worker, second or first shift most of the time. Dad's in the armed forces, and when he gets deployed, this happens with this particular child. And once you understand, he's really missing his dad. Sometimes dad's return date isn't very clear, so there's just a level of anxiety there. He spent summertime with dad, now dad's about to be deployed. So of course a kid in the fourth grade, 10 years old, might feel a certain way about that and may not have had anyone to talk to if it just came to a head right then. You're in front of me, so you're who I give it to. Well, let's not take that personally. So let's just say that he would have thrown a pencil at any teacher, not just you. So now that we've taken you out of the situation, what are our questions? Our questions are, what was his trigger? What happened that made a student have feelings of anger, and then what happened so that they couldn't control them or know what to do with them? So we had to check. I almost said his name. Young man, do you remember that there's a signal you can give if you're feeling angry that lets the teacher know, I'm walking out of the classroom, but I'm only going to the office. I'm going to check and see if the guidance counselor is here, and if they're not here, I'm going to my safe space. And it's Mr. Sanders because he's my favorite teacher and whatever, right? Did you remember that you can do that? Oh, I forgot. Okay, so next time, you know. And kids really appreciate when they're shown compassion, because when he told the teacher he was sorry, you can tell he meant it. It was through the restorative processes we found out what was really bothering him. We brought mom in, we talked, and mom was kind of, he's getting it. No, he's not getting any days, mom. Well, how long is he going to be out of class? As soon as we're confident, school and parent, that we'll work through this issue enough, doesn't have to be completely, but enough so that he can regulate his behavior, go in the classroom and learn and not be a disruption, he's back in class. I think he was out maybe a day and a half.
Officials say there are reasons to believe that the story we just heard from Principal Cameron Coleman is not an isolated event, that suspensions across the district for all grades are down this school year.
And true to the new ban, no students in preschool through second grade have been given out-of-school suspensions so far this year. Still, given everything, we felt it was important to ask Superintendent Kelvin Adams, what would failure look like?
Failure would look like people going around the policy to still do what we are trying to keep them from doing. That's number one. Number two, failure would look like us not providing support to schools. Number three, failure would look like our attendance going down as opposed to up. And right now, the preliminary indication is that it's going up. Because as the attendance goes up, it means that kids are having more seat time in the building and have a better chance of being taught as opposed to sitting at home. So I think that's what failure will look like. Failure will look like us not adequately keeping kids in school and supporting them the way we need to.
For Norm White, the criminologist working in the 7 elementary schools, failure would be if teachers and principals don't go a step further and recognize the link between discipline and racial equity in education.
I don't know that it's pushing racial equity because I don't think that the conversation is around race. You know, the conversation is around the policy and the practice. Mm-hmm. In our buildings, the conversation is around the policy and the practice, but how does race play into that? That makes a difference. Because what it means is that the schools and the staff in the building are thinking about how is our reaction impacting these young people that we're working with, and does it feed the racial inequality that we see? And if so, what should we do in response to that? That I think is a powerful thing.
That's a point that the staff at Adams Elementary have taken to heart. Principal Cameron Coleman says rethinking how the school handles discipline is really about rethinking how the school does, well, everything.
It's something we saw firsthand.
Yeah, for example, there's a classroom with standing desks, exercise balls for chairs, and mats on the floor.
In another classroom we saw, the kids were working with blues music playing in the background.
And the idea is we're going to stop telling kids to come here and be this way so that you can learn. So you're not going to come in and sit down and learn because you're not the client there. We're not providing a service. So if we're providing a service, we're figuring out, okay, well, this is how you learn best, and I'm going to make sure that I provide that for you.
The flexibility is balanced with guidelines and schedules. Coleman says that a clear sense of order helps remove anxiety for children who may be facing turmoil and uncertainty at home.
And encouraging good behavior in the classroom is woven deeply into lesson plans. For example, third grade teacher Grace Hogan is going over when it's okay to interrupt something called centers.
In case you're wondering, centers are when students at Adams spend time, based on their assessment data, working on specific math or reading skills.
If you have a smaller problem, like Stefan said, he has a question about his work, what could you do? Instead of interrupting, what could you do?
Leave it alone.
Raise your hand without interrupting centers.
Without interrupting, what else could you do, Josiah?
Try to figure it out by yourself.
Try and figure it out by yourself. Who else can you ask, Jabori?
You can ask a partner, or you can either just skip that answer and try to do the other one.
Oh my gosh! So that's like four things you could do instead of interrupting, Dwayne. I see you have really, really excited. Yes, sir.
Or you can just leave it alone.
You could leave it alone and come back to that problem,
Ding.
Right? Great.
Coleman says there's an intense understanding that each student is different and that shoring up student-teacher relationships will ultimately lead to success in the classroom.
Like one teacher we met who has her fourth grade students write in journals every single day, and then she writes them responses every single day.
This level of individual attention extends beyond the classroom and beyond the building, for that matter. Coleman says they've even gone to doctor's appointments with parents. Yeah.
So this kind of way, students get support faster, the network is stronger, there's a stronger element of trust with the parent, right? And it's helped us really practice how to have some tough conversations with parents that may need the guidance and support or education if they don't know where to turn with some things.
In education, all the feel-good vibes, all the great ideas, all the money, often boils down to a simple question. Are kids doing better on standardized tests?
Well, in the case of Adams Elementary and all schools in Missouri, the answer is sort of hard to come by. Without getting way deep into the weeds, the fight over the controversial Common Core state standards, it's this big national education fight that's been going on for years, has meant different tests in each of the last three school years in Missouri, because we had the standards, we threw them out, and then we made up some new standards. And anyways,
we'd need a whole show to explain.
No kidding, yeah. But here's the bottom line, right? You can't go apples to apples with previous years on test scores right now.
However, Coleman says he's starting to see progress in the classroom. And when the state gives out its annual report card for schools, which includes test scores along with non-academic results like attendance and behavior, Coleman says they expect to see big improvements.
But even if they don't, he says one thing is for sure. They can't go back to doing the things that they used to do.
Innovation is risk. Innovation is risk. We took risks, calculated risks. We knew what our response was going to be if we didn't have the outcomes that we anticipated. And we've had to make some mid-course self-corrections, but you keep moving forward. You treat yourself the same way you would treat a student that was struggling with a particular skill you were teaching them at that moment, right? You just find what the learning error is, go back to the drawing board and say, if we do X, we'll get a little bit closer to the goal.
Okay, guys, it's your favorite part, Cheesy Pugs. If you like what you hear and you like our storytelling, let us know by going to iTunes, becoming a subscriber if you're not one already. While you're there, leave us a 5-star review, please.
Only 5-star reviews.
5-star review. And if you're on NPR One, look down and click that interesting button. It really helps us out.
All right, We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is our fearless editor.
And Cassie Morgan composed our theme music.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From